Welcome to The Doctor Is Out, a podcast hosted by Dr. Sharif Akili, resident physician at Stanford Hospital and investor at Polaris Partners. Join Sharif in exploring the extraclinical practice of medicine as he interviews healthcare leaders who have gone from bedside to build companies, run health systems, spearhead public policy, and pursue many other paths where they lend their unique bedside perspectives.
Our guest today is the CEO of Scan Group and Health Plan, Sachin Jain. For those who may not know Sachin, he is the new CEO of Scan Group and Health Plan, a $3 billion nonprofit Medicare Advantage plan covering about 220,000 patients. Before being CEO of Scan, Sachin was also the CEO of CareMore Health System, a similar integrated health plan and care delivery system for Medicare and Medicaid patients. Sachin, you've had an incredibly fascinating and decorated career path before becoming CEOs of these transformative health systems. You worked some time with Don Berwick, you helped launch the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation, which for those who may not know is a key piece of the ACA that's allowed us to experiment with innovative alternative payment models and delivery systems and really move us away from these entrenched fee-for-service systems. You also worked at Merck for a time as Chief Medical Information and Innovation Officer. And by training, you're clinically an internist. You got your bachelor's, MBA, and MD from Harvard. You completed your residency at Brigham. And on top of all this, I can personally attest that you've been relentless in your mentorship, guidance, and support of students during and after you were faculty at Harvard Medical School and Harvard Business School. Sachin, thank you so much for joining me today. I really appreciate it.
It's an honor to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
Sachin, there are so many questions I hope we have time to get to. But I think the first one I think we can dig our teeth in is, what does it mean to be CEO of Scan Health or CareMore? Can you tell us a bit about those organizations and what your day-to-day job looks like?
Yeah, there's a lot of organizations that are actually that talk about doing value-based healthcare. I think one of the privileges of my career is that I've actually had the opportunity to be part of two organizations that have actually defined the field and are doing it, and doing it at scale. CareMore was an incredible organization, integrated plan provider organization that ultimately, I think pioneered a lot of the approaches that are getting a lot of recognition and credit right now around, chronic disease management, home-based care, a focus on the social determinants of health. Really an exceptional organization founded by, visionary physician, Dr. Sheldon Zinberg, had the privilege of leading that organization for 5.5 years, and then was asked to lead SCAN, which operates on an even bigger scale, $3.5 billion in revenue, serving over 220,000 patients over a number of counties in Southern California. And so it's just been really an incredible privilege to join these organizations, to lead these organizations, to learn from these organizations, and ultimately take them forward as we begin to pioneer a new future for American healthcare.
That's amazing. So what does your day-to-day look like, Sachin? Let's say I'm a medical student looking up to, the CEO of the health group I'm, rotating at. How does your job compare to a trainee or anything that we might be exposed to through the normal clinical education system?
So, it's interesting. My girlfriend thinks that all I do all day is like stare at spreadsheets. And so it's an interesting question. And I spend a little bit of my day actually looking at spreadsheets, but I would say for the most part, I spend my days actually in meetings, trying to learn from the people of our organization, trying to ask a lot of questions about where we are and where we're going, and try to synthesize a view of what the organization needs, and then try to work gently to nudge the organization in the right direction. Ultimately, it's just back-to-back-to-back-to-back meetings. And that's been exacerbated, frankly, by the pandemic and the times in which we live, where I'm constantly trying to get charge for my iPad or my cell phone because I'm literally on the phone, back-to-back for, 8, 9, 10 hours at a time. So if that doesn't sound good to you, I would recommend you think about a different career path than mine, because I think a lot of my life is about sitting in meetings with other people.
Interesting. So when you think about like the phenotype of a person who thrives in medicine or surgery or one of these specialties, is it safe to say that this might be a completely separate phenotype, maybe a little bit more extroverted phenotype than what you might otherwise get exposed to in your clinical rotations?
No, I think medicine is actually exceptional training for career management. I think it just has to be framed that way. I mean, I think the best way to think about it is you need a good combination of a high intensity of focus when you need it, as well as a certain amount of ADHD, because you need to be able to toggle between topics seamlessly, because in any given day, there's just a ton of variety. And I think that, you know, life on the wards actually feels a lot like that.
Yeah.
There are moments where there's a situation that requires all of your attention, but then you also have to be able to toggle to think about a lot of different patients, a lot of different orders at different times. And so I think the people who are, you know, most successful in their, you know, medical careers have an opportunity to be equally successful in a management career because that, you know, kind of mental framework is actually quite similar.
Do you think it was important that you went to business school and had these other experiences? Do you feel like you draw most from your medical training or business training or a little bit of everything?
There's no wasted training. I think it's very popular. It's popular lore in, you know, undergrad, medical school circles to talk about business school and disparaging, lens. They say, oh, it's just a networking place. And I actually think I learned a lot about the business of healthcare or just business in general through going to business school. I didn't grow up in a business family. My father's a physician. My mother's a homemaker. So ultimately I didn't have a language that allowed me to put words to different concepts. And I frequently describe business school as being akin to the first 2 years of medical school, where you're really learning the languages. You could certainly deploy yourself to the wards, you know, as a third year medical student without having gone through the first and second year of medical school, but you'd have far less context about what was actually happening. You wouldn't even have a vocabulary to describe what's happening. And so I think of business school as a vocabulary building opportunity that then enables your success going forward. I do have some thoughts about when I did business school, which was between my third and fourth year of medical school, which in retrospect, I believe was a mistake. Hmm. And it's why when I was a resident at the Brigham Women's Hospital, I worked with Joel Katz, the residency program director there, to co-found something called, you know, the John MacArthur Fellowship in Medicine and Management, which is an integrated internal medicine program and MBA. Because I think a lot of your skills in business, a lot of the business training you get goes unused for a number of years while you continue to train in medicine. And I think we also have this phenomenon of folks who are dually trained in medicine and business through MD-MBA programs who then divert themselves to go work in business directly after medical school. And I think that that's a mistake too. So I'm a huge fan of completion, of completing the swing on your full medical training, finishing residency, but then getting the business skills that you need to be successful going forward. You know, I'll also say another kind of component for me that's really important is remaining active in clinical practice. I continue to practice at CareMore. I'm presently in the process of actually getting credentialed at the West LA VA so that I can continue to practice there. And because I think it's very, very important to not lose sight of the frontline realities of what it's like to be a physician, what it's like to be a patient, what it's like to be a nurse. You can't manage or lead healthcare effectively or authentically unless you've actually spent some time doing it.
Sachin, would you have a clinic? Would you attend on the wards? And how often would you do that?
I'm going to be what's called a walk attending, which is a walk hospitalist attending. So walk is shorthand for without compensation, which is a designation that the VA offers for folks like me who are, you know, part-time, who have full other careers, who don't want all the obligations that come with being full-time faculty, but still want to contribute and practice clinically. It's what I did actually when I was an attending in Boston, when I was an executive at Merck, leading digital health for the company globally. I wanted to continue practice. So I spent, you know, 8 to 10 weeks a year as a walk attending in Boston. And I'm now kind of persisting in that here now that I work at SCAN.
That's interesting. And you know, that program you discussed just a moment ago at Brigham, I can attest through really close friends who have done it that I think it's one of the most powerful management programs that exists in the country. I wish so badly that Stanford did something like that, because I have a lot of internal medicine co-residents who I think would really thrive if they could get an MBA in conjunction with residency. I was wondering how were you.
I don't think you need to wish it. You just need to go talk to Bob Harrington and make it happen.
That's true.
He's a free thinker. Tell him I told him to do it.
All right. I'll point him to this exact conversation. Is that what you did? Did you just talk to your program director and
I wrote up a 2-page proposal. I organized a meeting between, you know, Joel Katz and originally the dean of the medical school, the dean of the business school at the time. And then he designated to a guy named Carl Kester, who was, you know, is kind of a senior faculty associate dean. And then, you know, Joel and the Department of Medicine went about raising funds in the name of John MacArthur, who was a significant figure in Boston. He had been the dean of Harvard Business School for a period of time, but then had also been chair of the board at Partners Healthcare, which now, of course, is known as Mass General Brigham. And so, you know, he was this very unique person who had stretched between Harvard Business School and also the Brigham and Mass General. And so it wasn't that hard to raise funds in his name, just given his immense contributions to both communities.
Wow, that's amazing. Well, I feel inspired right there, Sachin. Thanks. I'm going to pivot a little bit. And I want to go back to when you were, let's say, an MD, MBA student in the Harvard program there. Because you had such an interesting, little bit winding path, and it almost seems like you were just doing whatever your heart was like making you jump to do in that moment, if we were to go back and discuss each of these pathways. But if you think if you went back and you spoke to yourself at age 25, what do you think you might have been doing 10, 15 years later back then?
Well, I can tell you what I wrote in my AMCAS essay. That was written at age 22. And at the time, I don't know if they still have this question. The AMCAS had this question, which was, you know, what do you see yourself doing in 10 years? And I imagined myself as a general internal medicine researcher at Mount Sinai Hospital, or, you know, because it was close to where I grew up in New Jersey. And that's kind of what I imagined myself doing. I thought I was going to research health policy, promulgate my findings, and that they would magically get translated into new health policies through kind of the brilliance of the findings. And at the end of the day, when he was writing a book on the history of U.S. healthcare policy through the lens of the presidency, where I realized that health policy moves incredibly slowly in this country. And if you want to create change through policy, work actually influences policy at the scale that I think we imagine it. And oftentimes it's not deliberate, it's actually by accident. And so, you know, to me that felt like a high risk proposition if you were trying to create change in healthcare. And so I pivoted along the way to pursue management, you know, alongside my health policy interests, because I knew that at least at the organizational level, there would be an opportunity to drive change and influence, you know, progress in U.S. healthcare. And that's certainly borne out. Now, I did go back to my health policy dreams when Obama was elected president.
Yeah.
And, you know, spent 2 years, you know, working in the administration, first with David and then with my college mentor, Don Berwick, and, you know, had an incredible experience. But again, I think I was lucky. I got to be part of the government at a time when a lot was changing. I'm not sure that that's everyone's experience with working in government.
Yeah, yeah. Can you tell us a little bit about that? What was it like working with Don on launching the CMMI? Were you just flying by the seat of your pants? Everything was new, figuring out how you were going to build something that would make a difference? Or did you find that there was a lot of work that was simmering there that you just sort of were able to execute at the time?
Sharif, it was an incredibly humbling experience. And it was an amazing, amazing time. If anyone is, my advice to anyone on this who's listening to this podcast, if you're ever interested in going to government, just go. And, you know, some people wait around for the White House fellowship or, you know, try their hands at different, you know, different kind of pathways in. I would just say, you know, find somebody who's in government and go follow them, and you will learn a lot. You'll see a lot. It'll change your vision of the art of what's possible. It'll give you a much clearer view into the sausage making in terms of why things are the way they are. We had this incredible experience of launching CMMI, going from, you know, just a handful of employees to 80 employees to a couple hundred employees over subsequent months and years. You know, kind of looking at the intent that was articulated in the legislation versus what political figures in the administration wanted it to be. And, you know, again, I think it was just an incredible, incredible time. It was actually how I first discovered CareMore, how I first learned of CareMore, because as CMMI was being formed, we were just privileged to be able to meet the world of healthcare innovators who came to DC to tell their stories, to understand how they may work with the Innovation Center collaboratively. And so, again, I think it just, I made some of the best friends of my life working in government. It was a short period of time relatively, but it had a disproportionate impact on, you know, my life's work and trajectory going forward. So just a very, very special time.
You did that in the middle of residency. Is that right? You took 2 years off from residency at Brigham to do that?
I did. I got a page one day from my residency program director, Joel, and he said, hey, it sounds like, you know, some folks in DC might want you to go work there. And I said, yeah, I mean, I've heard a little bit about some opportunities and some possibilities. He said, I want to let you know you have my full support if that's what you want to do. And I said, okay, I'm thrilled that you would support me in doing that. I mean, not every residency program director in the country says, you know, likes losing a body, so to speak. Right. And then, you know, there's this question of like whether he would take me back. And he assured me that he would take me back, but actually, you know, my mother wanted it in writing. And so he actually sent me a letter in writing to kind of reaffirm that he would take me back into training. And I was very fortunate that, you know, he got me back into the program when it was time for me to finish my training. I will say it was a jarring experience coming back. Being off cycle with your class makes you realize how much, how social the experience of being a trainee really is. It's, you know, it's about the patients. Certainly it's about the learning. It's about the training, but it's also about being with people you love. And so I had to, you know, integrate myself with a brand new class where I didn't know anyone, which I thought was, it was a bit jarring, honestly, to come back to.
Was that a tough decision to take time off? Forget that you had your position secured. Did you think of the opportunity cost of taking a couple of years to work in government, sort of coming back to residency and sort of chopping up your career path? Or were you, was that not actually that difficult decision at the time?
It felt like exactly what I needed to do. I mean, you know, this was, you know, I had been an undergraduate student studying health policy. And one of the kind of key concepts in the public policy literature is this concept of a policy window. There's a political scientist known as John Kingdon, who talks about these policy windows where, you know, you've got many years where nothing happens, and then all of a sudden a lot happens. And with Obama, it was very clear that, you know, between a Democratic president, Democratic Congress, and Democratic Senate, that big things were going to happen. And so I just to be there, honestly, Sharif. I just wanted to be worked. I wanted to be a part of it, and it was just super special. And I'm so grateful to people like, you know, Don and David, who gave me that chance to be there. It was remarkable, remarkable time.
That's amazing. That's amazing. And you know, I think this might be a good time to ask this question. Back then, right now, looking forward, what are your thoughts on the right legislation that would help advance our healthcare system forward, particularly as it comes to whether we should advocate for or support a single payer system or maybe the public option, which was originally part of the ACA that was later stripped, but now there seems to be more momentum. Have you had thoughts about which system might make most sense? Do you feel like there's a clear answer or is this... I usually find myself having a lot of humility before that question only because I feel like there's so much uncertainty on what will happen. But I was curious how have you thought about it as not only the CEO of SCAN, but someone who's worked pretty extensively in policy before?
Yeah, I'm super biased, and there's a recency bias, and there's kind of the position that I sit in bias. But what I can say is I actually believe the uniquely American solution to healthcare for all will be Medicare Advantage for all. For those of you who are unfamiliar with Medicare Advantage, it is privately administered Medicare. So the federal government writes a check to a Medicare Advantage plan for a, you know, per member per month premium that then can then be spent on medical that a private company, or in our case a nonprofit, you know, public organization, is then ultimately using to manage the total cost of care for patients. And you know, we've been able to show through a number of years that Medicare Advantage allows you to lower total cost of care. It also allows you to provide richer benefits to members, to patients. And so I think that America is ready for and wants a solution that works for everyone. I think everyone's tired of employer-based healthcare. I think the pandemic has shown us how fragile our system of employer-based healthcare really is. But I think it also has reinforced for me the idea that the American public doesn't trust the federal government to do everything. And so this idea of a public-private hybrid, publicly funded, privately administered, which is what Medicare Advantage for All would be, I think is the uniquely American solution. It may not be the best solution, but I think it's the solution that Americans writ large are most likely to adopt and appreciate as a comprehensive solution to the problem of, you know, providing universal access.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I think it would still give a lot of room for entrepreneurs to build companies and sell to different systems and experiment and innovate.
I think competition then becomes real. I think, you know, everyone gets into this business of being an integrated payer provider, which ultimately I think becomes pretty compelling. And so folks will then stop viewing narrow networks as restriction of choice. But they'll instead look at it as, you know, do I want to be this part of this integrated system or that integrated system? And I think it's very hard to sell the benefits of what integrated care looks like to someone who hasn't experienced it, because we've all become so attuned to the dysfunction of the current system and so used to the dysfunction of the current system. So I actually think we have incredible opportunities to make things, you know, remarkably better.
Very cool. Very cool. Sasha, how did you find yourself going from the provider side of healthcare working on the ACA to then the farmer side working at Merck? And then you came back to the provider side, becoming CEO of CareMore.
You know, a lot of it was throwing away kind of the plan that I had for myself. I think, you know, oftentimes when you're a trainee, you become attuned to thinking about the world very linearly. And you also read bios like mine that kind of read linearly. First he did this, then he did that, then he did that. Yep. You know, and then what you don't realize is that there's all kinds of interesting things that happen once you get out of the PGY mindset, which is the whole world of opportunity exists. And you start having conversations with people and you start asking yourselves questions like, who's interesting? Who's inspiring? Where am I going to have the opportunity to make the biggest difference? Where am I going to have the opportunity to gain the most skill? And sometimes, you know, the answer that you had when you were 22 writing that AMCAS essay is really different than the answer that you have when you're 32 graduating residency and trying to figure out, you know, where you're going to be. And you have to start to test some of these assumptions in the real world. And when I was coming out of my time in residency, where I had already spent a couple of years in government, government spoiled me. I had operated on this huge platform where you're trying to change healthcare for the United States. And the idea of kind of going to a single hospital and working on projects or initiatives or even leading small divisions in these large systems felt really, really small. The things that were appealing to me even 5 or 10 years ago no longer were appealing because my so-called tastes or sense of self had really changed. And Merck at the time was building, made a significant investment in digital health and real world data, and had asked me initially to work with them as a consultant to help them identify someone to lead these efforts. And they had asked me to help scope some of these efforts, and kind of in this, you know, Dick Cheney, you know, becomes, you know, vice president sort of way, they turned to me and said, would you be interested in actually doing the job? And I hadn't thought about it. And subsequently then, you know, had an interview with Ken Frazier, who was the CEO of Merck at the time, and tremendously inspirational person. And then, you know, also was just really compelled by Michael Rosenblatt, who was going to be my boss there, an incredible leader in medicine, you know, someone you should have on this show as well, you know, had just a tremendous career, was president of the Beth Israel Hospital in Boston, was the dean of the HST Society, dean of at Harvard Medical School, dean of Tufts Medical School, was one of the kind of lead scientists in the discovery of Fosamax. So just had this tremendously eclectic career, but more importantly, was just an incredible gentleman and mentor and somebody who, you know, I continue to talk to, you know, quite often. You know, you get to a point in your life where you think, okay, I have an opportunity to work with someone amazing, learn from them, and frankly, hopefully learn to be more like them. And, you know, this combination of the opportunity to work with both Ken and Mike was frankly too hard to give up. Now, the real world experience inside of Merck was kind of a funny lesson in, you know, working in a corporation. You know, didn't have any sense of the pressures that organizations face as it relates to quarterly earnings, how that changes investments in, you know, new entities. I was also had this experience of being a young, you know, associate vice president in a company where it usually took people 20 or 25 years of experience to get to that level. And so, you know, generated antibodies. I probably didn't have the kind of, you know, self-awareness or political sophistication of knowing how to navigate, work with legal, work with compliance to get things done. And so it was frankly a bumpy ride for me. I learned a ton, but my heart was really always in the delivery system. And so when I got this phone call in October 2014 from a friend asking me, you know, whether I would ever think about moving to California, my initial answer was no, because I was at the time a real East Coast guy. But then I asked him what the organization was, and he said CareMore. And I was just reminded of my time at CMMI and how innovative an organization CareMore was, that I just jumped at the opportunity to go and at least check it out. And so, again, I think one of the most important things is you have to be open to left turns in your life. And so many folks are just always looking to do exactly the right thing. And sometimes you miss out on life's biggest opportunities when you're just trying to do the right thing. And so, you know, I would just encourage everyone listening to be open to chance, be open to possibilities. The funny thing about medical training is you always can go back and be a doctor.
Yep.
If you're looking to have a non-traditional career, like really double down on it, you know, really, you know, make the most of it, because you do have that security blanket, that safety blanket of a firm professional grounding that many people don't have the privilege of enjoying. So, you know, that would be my strong encouragement to the listening audience, is to be comfortable taking risks, taking chances, because in the end, you learn the most when you kind of get out of your comfort zone.
It's so interesting. Rashika said a very similar thing. He said, you know, physicians were pretty risk averse, but ironically, we have the ability to be the most risk prone because we have this backup. Because you can always moonlight, because you won't go hungry. That's really insightful.
I think the only thing I would just encourage there is being thoughtful around how you manage your finances. I think many people, because of the delayed gratification of 10 years of residency, as soon as they start earning a paycheck, sometimes over commit and find themselves in financial positions where they can't take risks. They have too many fixed costs, so to speak. And so I would just encourage those of you out there who are, you know, early on this journey to make sure you're being thoughtful about your financial planning, your personal financial planning. Because you know, one of the things that enabled me to go to, you know, DC was, you know, I didn't have any other big commitments. I could just pick up and go. And I think that's the kind of thing that you just have to always, and one of my experiences working in government was actually trying to recruit a lot of, you know, kind of the household name brand type people that you're aware of that you're probably going to have on this show to come work in government. And they would always say, man, I would love to do that, but unfortunately it's not going to pay my mortgage payment, or I've got X, Y, or Z, you know, kind of finance to achieving your dreams or pursuing your dreams. You need to be in a financially sound position where you're not necessarily carrying a lot of fixed costs that are avoidable. So I would just encourage, you know, folks to think about how you manage your finances actually influences your ability to take risk.
Makes sense. Well, Sachin, thank you so much for your time. This was extraordinarily insightful. I've learned a lot. Really appreciate you taking the time to chat with me today.
It's great to be with you, and I'll look forward to staying in touch.
That does it for this episode of The Doctor Is Out. Thanks for joining us. If you enjoyed this episode and would like to support us, please leave a review on Apple Podcast or whichever podcast platform you use. And if there's something you found you really liked, or didn't like, or would like to make a suggestion, feel free to reach out by email at info@tdio.org.